who had turned on Hogan, had put a stipulation in the contract that if Hogan lost via DQ, he lost the title. Therefore, Giant was to get the WCW title. But WCW's storyline and real-life attorney, Nick Lambrose, claimed WCW wasn't recognizing this stipulation. However, instead of recognizing Hogan as the champion again, he just said the belt was vacant, pending an upcoming World War III pay-per-view battle royal. Although the storyline was that WCW never recognized the title change, every single title history in existence plus wrestling lore lists Giant as winning the title in his first ever match. Not that any of this matters much. Randy Savage ended up winning the title in the battle royal. December was notable for being the first time that either company booked a television overrun period. Nitro ran Savage versus Luger for the title on December 4, and the show ran 10 minutes past the top of the hour. Because a rating always grows during a match, and because you're invariably going to get a bump due to people tuning in to see whatever show is scheduled to air next, you can inflate your rating with an overrun. Nitro was up 0.2 as a result, tying their record 2.6 rating and beating Raw, although barely, as viewership for both shows was creeping up. From that point forward, Nitro booked an overrun virtually every week. Overruns became an accepted part of Monday Night Pro Wrestling to the point that WWE still does an overrun today, despite Raw having zero head-to-head wrestling competition and the show already being 3 hours long going in. While most would consider what happened on December 18, 1995, just another shocking angle in the Monday Night Wars, in reality, it was another pivotal day in the history of pro wrestling. On Nitro, Deborah Michelli, who had been working in WWF as Alundra Blaze and was in fact their women's champion, showed up on Nitro with her title belt, tossed it in a garbage can live on air, and said that was what she thought of the WWF and their championship belt. She said Nitro's tagline was that this was where the big boys played, but as of today, it was also where the big girls played. Vince McMahon was shocked. Why he was shocked is anyone's guess, given that her contract had expired a week earlier and they hadn't bothered to take the title off of her. The move led to a bitter lawsuit between the two sides that ultimately played into Vince McMahon's decision-making during the Montreal Screwjob years later, a night that changed pro wrestling forever. I was under contract with WCW and was told to do what I had to do, and if not, you're fired and would have no income coming in, Michelli noted. Eric Bischoff told me that I had to put the WWF women's title in the trash on television, or that was it. It was put down as if it was totally my fault. However, people don't want to see the other side, and that it was pure entertainment. If I was asked how I felt, and if I would have done it by my own choice, the answer would have been no. On Raw that same night, Steve Austin debuted as the Ringmaster. When people state this was a golden era in wrestling, this is why. Nearly every Monday night had something that would have fans talking throughout the week. And, as you can see, the battle lines had been drawn. But the war had not yet started in earnest. Things were about to get a lot more interesting and a lot more ugly. You want a war? You got one. Scott Hall to Eric Bischoff, Monday Nitro, May 27, 1996. Chapter 2, 1996. The War Begins. From the time WCW and the WWF first emerged as the two major leagues of professional wrestling, fans had debated who would win in a showdown between the two. Many knew that the whole business was in fact predetermined, but it was still fun to contemplate the awesome matchups that would take place should the two companies ever compete under one banner. In fact, many wrestling magazines seemed to stay in business by publishing at least one article detailing interpromotional dream matches each month. Every fan hoped to see, once and for all, which of the two organizations was truly superior. From the day you first watch wrestling and see all the amazing characters, it's natural to dream about cross-federation matches, champion versus champion, notes legendary wrestling magazine writer Bill Apter. When I worked for the magazines full-time, we took it one step further and made the dream match seem more like a reality. Everyone loved it, and that showed by the mail we used to get each time we published one. So when Scott Hall appeared on Nitro for the very first time, it should have come as no shock that the fans suddenly sat up and took notice. His debut certainly was unique. In the past, promotions typically released video packages to detail a wrestler's imminent arrival. These would establish just who the character was, what his motives were, etc., to create a buzz before he ever stepped foot in the ring. With Hall, however, WCW concluded that everyone knew who he was, since he had been an integral part of the WWF's upper card for the better part of the past 3 years. Therefore, no packages were produced, and nothing was ever mentioned. No, Scott Hall just showed up on Nitro one night and grabbed the promotion by the balls. The night was May 27, 1996, a night that, for many reasons, was a turning point in the history of wrestling. It just happened to be the week that Nitro made a huge jump, expanding from 1 hour to two. Since Raw ran from 9 to 10 p.m., Bischoff decided to run Nitro from 8 to 10, giving the show one full unopposed hour to build up the second hour as a must-see. Turner was happy because the show in the 8 to 9 slot, Thunder in Paradise, which ironically featured Hulk Hogan in a leading role, was doing miserable numbers. In exchange for the programming, Turner agreed to pay WCW $2 million per year for the added hour. Because attendance at WCW live events had started taking off months earlier due to a Randy Savage versus Ric Flair feud, yes, Ric Flair, who was not only unretired again, but had, shockingly, briefly won the world title twice in the prior 6 months, and actually pinned Hulk Hogan for the first time since their feud began 5 years and 9 million matches earlier, this additional revenue meant that the company had reached a new milestone. For the first time in history, it turned a profit. It was on this occasion, as Nitro expanded to fill its new time slot, that the Scott Hall deal unfolded. During the midst of a mid-card match featuring Steve Dahl and the Mauler, Mike Enos, that's right, and for historical purposes, it should be noted that, aside from Hall's appearance, this show totally blew, Hall jumped the rail from the stands and grabbed a microphone. It looked for all the world like a completely unscripted event, and immediately fans began to think something was up. After all, here was this big WWF star invading Nitro. Those fans were even more suspicious when Hall made his way to the ring and began to speak. "Hey, you people know who I am, but you don't know why I am here. Where is Billionaire Ted? Where is the Nacho Man? Where's Scheme Gene?" The mystery continued to build as Hall hunted down the announce team, including Eric Bischoff himself. "Bischoff, you got a big mouth. You started it. Now we're going to finish it." He also mentioned that he wasn't alone, and that he'd have a, quote, "big surprise" for all of WCW the following week. "You want a war?" Hall asked. "You got one." WCW got one, all right. A real-life war with the WWF that resulted in a real-life lawsuit filed by McMahon's company on June 20th. The suit cited, among other things, unfair competition with regard to WCW's portrayal of this as an interpromotional angle. Ironic given WWF's portrayal of Ric Flair in 1991. Trademark infringement. Hall looked and spoke too much like Razor Ramon for their tastes. Unfair competition. WCW had allegedly claimed on its 900 hotline that WWF was ready to file for bankruptcy. A stretch, but this was the year in which WWF was closest to going under in its entire history. And a defamation and libel for an incident in which the power went out at Nitro and Bischoff implied that, quote, "the competition" might have had something to do with it. And this was only the latest legal volley from the McMahon side. Earlier in the year, he'd filed a long complaint to the FTC Bureau of Competition, citing everything from alleged contract tampering to the, quote, unprecedented act of starting Nitro a few minutes early and ending it a few minutes late. All efforts by WCW, he believed, to kill WWF and create a monopoly over U.S. pro wrestling. 10 years after McMahon largely did the same, although that fact wasn't mentioned in the complaint. Long story short, his goal was to have Time Warner investigate WCW and the fact that it had lost over $40 million since being purchased by Turner in 1988, with the hopes that, to avoid merger headaches, everyone involved would just opt to drop the wrestling division. This would have signaled a much earlier death of WCW. The great irony was at the time Vince lodged his complaint, WWF was actually having somewhat of a business turnaround, having done a great buy rate for Royal Rumble and good house show business both domestically and internationally. The biggest difference between the two promotions was that Eric Bischoff was touting how WCW had turned the ratings war around. Funny, in the 6 weeks prior to the complaint being lodged, Raw had won 3 weeks, and Nitro had won 3 weeks. In addition to that, prior to the Raw-Nitro war and Bischoff going on and on about ratings, the reality is that nobody in wrestling really cared about ratings at all, and there were very often periods, particularly in the early 90s, where WCW's ratings were consistently better than WWF's. In those days, though, it didn't matter, because business success or failure was determined by house show numbers and pay-per-view buy rates. The week after the June 20th lawsuit, Hall delivered on his threat as Kevin Nash, who had competed as Diesel in the WWF, made his debut. Not only was Nash a former WWF champion, he was also the man around whom McMahon had developed his most recent marketing campaign, the, quote, New Generation, the idea being that Nash was fresh, while the guys in WCW, like Hogan and Savage, were yesterday's news. Like Hall, Nash began to berate Bischoff and WCW as a whole. You've been out here running your mouth for 6 months, Nash bellowed. This is where the big boys play? What a joke. The implication was clear. Bischoff had taken shot after shot at the WWF on Nitro, pulling stunts like announcing the results of the taped shows and mocking their top stars. Now, here were two of the WWF's biggest names confronting Bischoff about his actions and threatening to dismantle WCW to its very core. In a stroke of what can only be described as genius, the words WWF, Razor Ramon, and Diesel were never mentioned. Indeed, the loudest words were unspoken. On top of all this was the irony of WCW throwing around references to the WWF's entire series of billionaire Ted parody skits. The skits, in which elderly actors played knockoffs of Hogan, the Huckster, and Randy Savage, the Nacho Man, did little more for the WWF than further stir interest in WCW's product. Everything led to the Great American Bash pay-per-view, an event so shockingly great from both an in-ring and booking standpoint that many fans at the time went as far as to call it the greatest U.S. pay-per-view of all time. Right before the main event, Hall and Nash showed up again and interrupted the proceedings to a bigger reaction than almost anyone else on the show. In fact, the crowd began to chant, Diesel! Diesel! Amazingly enough, neither man had even been named by the promotion at this point. After berating Bischoff once more, Hall and Nash made their demand clear. A 3-on-3 match for the upcoming Bash at the Beach pay-per-view. Bischoff agreed, and Hall asked who WCW's three men would be. Bischoff wouldn't say, so Hall punched him in the stomach, doubled him over, and sent him into the waiting arms of Nash. Nash then lifted Bischoff high into the air and powerbombed him off the stage and through the table below. The crowd went absolutely crazy. Armageddon had arrived. The WWF was here, and they were taking out WCW from the very top. Before we continue, It must be said that the manner in which WCW initially booked Hall and Nash was nothing short of phenomenal. The whole idea behind drawing money in wrestling is actually pretty basic. Create a match that fans want to see, and, more importantly, one that they are willing to pay to see. If fans perceive that one side has zero chance of winning, they won't want to see the bout. After all, the outcome of such an encounter would be predetermined, which is ironic since all pro wrestling is predetermined. It's also crucial that the two factions are perceived as equals. If a main eventer takes on a lower card guy, fans will likely reject the match. When Hall and Nash made their debuts, they were treated as something very out of the ordinary. In fact, they were made to look absolutely dominant. They were a huge threat, not only to this wrestler or that wrestler, but also to the entire company of WCW as a whole. Never before had two men simply come into a company and acted like it was their personal playground. It was called an attempted hostile takeover, and by God, that's just what it was. During matches in which they weren't involved, the announce team would talk about them, fearing what might happen when they showed up. These outsiders were such a threat that not only was everyone on the alert, but at one point the announce team even had armed guards to protect their positions. It's one thing to KO a guy in a wrestling ring, it's another altogether to be so dominant and intimidating that security guys with guns are required. Lesson not learned. Over the years, countless invasions have happened in the world of pro wrestling. These have all paled in comparison to the original WCW debuts of Hall and Nash. And the reason is almost always the same. The incoming force is treated as a true threat for a week or two, then is portrayed as the same as everyone else on the roster. For instance, they will have theme music that sounds just like the ones heard on the show for years prior. They are given entrances that look the same. They give interviews at the same times during a show as the others. When Hall and Nash debuted, they were different. They were unique, and they were kept that way until they were more established. And once established, their music was radically different. Their entrance was different. Everything was different. And they were immediately programmed with the top guys in the company. End result? They were taken very seriously and led the company to its greatest success. This was a threat WCW took very seriously. The only way to fight guys who were the top stars in the WWF was to use their own main eventers. In fact, on the very first night that Hall showed up, none other than Sting came out to defend WCW's honor. It made sense, as Sting was often viewed as the promotion's franchise player. Unlike nearly everyone else in WCW, he'd never left the company and had remained true to WCW through all of its ups and downs. If anyone could block this WWF onslaught, it would be the Stinger. But he would definitely need backup. And in this case, he got it in the form of two of WCW's other top stars, Randy Savage and Lex Luger. So Team WCW was set. But leading up to Bash at the Beach, one question remained. Who would Hall and Nash, now dubbed the Outsiders, have as their mystery partner? Indeed, one of the biggest selling points of the pay-per-view was the chance to see just who the third guy was. Although mystery partner angles almost always turn out to be complete flops in wrestling, the fact that WCW had delivered two monumental surprises in the appearances of Hall and Nash convinced fans that WCW would unveil another huge name. Right up until the ring introductions, the question remained, who was the third man? There were several schools of thought as to just who would wind up as Hall and Nash's mystery partner, both in the minds of fans and behind the scenes. Since Hall and Nash had just jumped ship, and it appeared that McMahon was having problems holding on to his talent, one theory had yet another WWF main eventer jumping ship, Bret Hart. And since it was known that Bret was unhappy with his current position in the WWF hierarchy, he seemed a likely third man. In reality, Bischoff wouldn't begin negotiations with Bret until months after the Bash, so it was never going to be him. As the crowd craned their necks towards the entrance ramp, Michael Buffer made the introductions. But something wasn't right. Only Hall and Nash made their way toward the ring. The announce crew immediately cried that this was unfair, and this really said something. After all, shouldn't the WCW announce crew have been happy that it was now a handicap match? Apparently not, as Tony Schiavone, practically in tears, screamed, "They've got to tell us who the third man is right now." His announce colleague, Bobby Heenan, countered, "They know what they're doing. They're keeping us on the edge of our seats and making our palms sweat." They sure were. They had the entire crowd and all those watching at home antsy about what the hell was going on. Gene Okerlund made his way to the ring and demanded to know who the third man was. Hall, channeling the Puerto Rican accent he had used as Razor Ramon, retorted, quote, "You know, Scheme Gene. You know too much already. All you need to know, little man, is that he's here, and he's ready." Nash followed up and proclaimed, "He's here all right, Gene, but we're enough to handle it here, right now." And he was right. Nash and Hall began a complete dissection of the WCW crew, knocking Luger out of the match almost immediately. This furthered speculation that perhaps Luger would reemerge as the third member. That wasn't in the plans, however. And just in case fans at home hadn't caught on that Nash and Hall were bad news, the announcers began to beg for a third guy to come out, so that Team WCW would once again have a 3-on-2 advantage. They needed the help, too, as the outsiders beat the ever-loving crap out of Sting and Savage. Note to wrestling promoters, this is how you book strong heels. Finally, Sting was able to make the hot tag to Savage, and the crowd went insane. One low blow later, though, Savage was once again down. Just as things began to look most bleak, WCW's biggest star hit the aisle, Hulk Hogan. As he came down the ramp, the fans cheered. WCW was finally saved. Hogan surveyed the ring. Hall and Nash had dropped to the floor, leaving Randy Savage alone in the ring, flat on his back. Hogan looked around the ring nervously and glanced momentarily at the crowd. No doubt Terry Bollea had serious reservations as to what his wrestling persona was about to do. For the first time in over a decade, and for the first time since he had taken the nation by storm as Hulk Hogan, he was about to become a heel. The third man had arrived. Hogan dropped the leg across Savage's throat. Sting came back in to make the save, but was promptly thrown out. Again and again, Hogan nailed Savage, stopping only to high-five his new friends. The wrestling world had its new number one heel, and WCW was about to take off into the stratosphere. Gene Okerlund hit the ring once more to find out what the hell had just happened. Hogan launched into a tirade. "Mean Gene, the first thing you need to do is tell these people to shut up if you want to hear what I got to say. The first thing you've got to realize, brother, is that this is the future of wrestling. You can call this the New World Order of Wrestling, brother." And thus the group had its name. What about its motives? These two men right here come from a great big organization up north. And everybody was wondering who the third man was. Well, who knows more about that organization than me, brother? I made that organization a monster. I made people rich up there. I made the people that ran that organization rich up there, brother. And when it all came to pass, the name Hulk Hogan, the man Hulk Hogan, got bigger than the whole organization. And then, Billionaire Ted, he wanted to talk turkey with Hulk Hogan. Billionaire Ted promised me movies. He promised me millions of dollars. And he promised me world-caliber matches. As far as Billionaire Ted, as far as Eric Bischoff, and as far as the whole WCW goes, I'm bored, brother. Fans began to get irate and hurled trash into the ring. What began as a paper cup here or there had become a flood of garbage that washed over Hogan, Hall, and Nash. In fact, the entire area was becoming less like a wrestling ring and more like a landfill confined by ropes and turnbuckles. Hogan continued, As far as I'm concerned, all the crap in this ring represents these fans out here. For 2 years, I held my head high. I did everything for the charities. I did everything for the kids. And the reception I got when I came out here, you fans can stick it, brother. Because if it wasn't for Hulk Hogan, you people wouldn't be here. If it wasn't for Hulk Hogan, Eric Bischoff would still be selling meat from a truck in Minneapolis. And if it wasn't for Hulk Hogan, wrestling wouldn't be here. Tony Schiavone concluded the telecast with these words. We have seen the end of Hulkamania. Hulk Hogan, you can go to hell. Straight to hell. At this point, the New World Order name was here to stay, despite commentator Larry Zbyszko's best efforts to call them the New World Odor. That Larry, he was a damn clever man. The angle was a culmination of many things that had happened in both companies over the past year. For Hall and Nash, they left a company that had lost $4.4 million in the 1994 through 1995 fiscal year to jump to a company which had, for the first time since Turner bought them in 1988, finally turned a small profit in 1995. Hall went from an upper mid-carder to a main eventer, and Nash went from a failed WWF champion, a guy who, while they tried to push him as the new Hulk Hogan, ended up being, up to that point, the worst drawing champion in company history, to a tippy-top main event superstar in WCW. For Hogan, fans had grown bored with the goody-two-shoes image that Hogan had used for so many years. Indeed, a handful of fans had already been booing Hogan in his appearances leading up to the turn, and now they were given carte blanche to scream their lungs out against the guy. Hogan, having seen his popularity decline, was truly at a career crossroads. Being a bad guy wasn't something he wanted to do, per se, but Bischoff had made an excellent argument. As a babyface, Hogan had worn out his welcome, but as a heel, he would be at the top of the cards once more. It was a good argument, but Bollea was still undecided. He had strong reservations about leaving behind what was a secure, though not as profitable as it had once been, role as wrestling's number one good guy. He was already starting to wane as a babyface. What if he flopped as a heel? Bad guys didn't sell t-shirts, and they didn't take starring roles in movies. In fact, as a heel, Hogan had never main-evented wrestling shows either. Although none but the hardest of hardcore fans knew it, Hogan had started his national career as a heel for the World Wrestling Federation in 1979, wrestling under the tutelage of evil managers like Fred Blassie, and taking on fan favorites like Andre the Giant. In fact, his first babyface turn came by accident, as he was supposed to debut for Vern Gagne's AWA on August 9, 1981 as a heel, but for whatever reason, the fans went wild for him. By the middle of 1996, Hogan had few options. His WCW contract would be due after two more pay-per-views, and he had no leverage left. He had tried one of his usual tricks months earlier, and it had backfired. The NBA playoffs were coming up, so he left to film a movie. Of course, the playoffs wreaked havoc on Nitro's ratings, and his plan was to come back and say the reason they were down was because he was gone. There was a flaw in his plan, however. He was gone too long, and when the playoffs ended, Nitro returned and started doing better numbers than when he had been main eventing every week. So, less than 2 weeks before the bash, Hogan decided to take the gamble and turn heel. The gamble paid off. Hulk Hogan, bad guy, along with Hall and Nash, became the talk of the wrestling industry. His career was instantly rejuvenated, giving WCW a huge shot in the arm. Fans who hadn't been following the business suddenly wanted to know just what could have caused such a catastrophic turn of events. The following night on Nitro, Hogan launched into yet another tirade, echoing his sentiments from the previous night, and adding that if the fans didn't like what he had to say, they could stick it. Anyone involved in wrestling, especially promoters and bookers, should take note that even when things appear to be taking off, nothing happens overnight. All of the angles that WCW booked in mid-1996 certainly increased casual fan interest in the product. The interest, however, did not immediately turn the company's fortunes around. In fact, despite all the awesome hype leading up to Bash at the Beach, the show actually did fewer buys than the same pay-per-view the year prior, a 0.71 versus a 0.82. Nitro ratings were up, but that was slightly deceptive, partially owing to the addition of an unopposed first hour. And house show business, legitimately up a whopping 125%, was the result of the Flair versus Savage feud that had started earlier in the year and had nothing to do with the NWO. With Hogan, Hall, and Nash running roughshod over WCW, it became apparent that the entire promotion would begin to rally together as a group to fight this invasion. The Giant, WCW World Champion at the time, stepped up to the plate to defend WCW's honor, in addition to the title. This was a major turning point in the early formation of the angle, since the Giant had been a heel right up until Hogan's heel turn. And indeed, it was all of WCW against the New World Order, as the invaders began to assail anyone and everyone within the company with a series of sneak attacks, spray-painting their victims with an NWO tag. One such attack saw the near 7-foot Kevin Nash launch 5'2" Rey Mysterio Jr. into the side of a truck like a lawn dart. Arn Anderson of the Four Horsemen was also injured during the beatdown, showing that the NWO didn't care who was a face or heel on the WCW side of things. All were enemies to them. Everyone, from legends like Ric Flair to opening match guys like Brad Armstrong, stood united against the NWO's onslaught. To stand up to such numbers, it was clear that Hogan, Hall, and Nash would need to bring in more members. And so came Hog Wild, an annual pay-per-view event emanating from the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. The matches took place in the middle of a field of thousands of drunken bikers, whom WCW did not charge to attend the event. In other words, the gate was $0. Despite this lack of revenue, the company would hold the event over the next several years, primarily due to the fact that Eric Bischoff was such a huge motorcycle enthusiast. On this occasion, commentators Dusty Rhodes and Tony Schiavone opened the program proclaiming that WCW had stumbled upon new evidence that the NWO was growing and that their numbers would increase by at least one man by the end of the evening. The show itself was rather boring and bland, aside from a women's match featuring Medusa, Deborah Michelli, formerly known as Alundra Blaze, who had made quite a name for herself a year or so earlier, when she showed up on Nitro and threw the WWF women's title into the garbage. On this night, Michelli took on Bull Nakano from Japan. Nakano was quite the sight, a 200-plus-pound brute of a woman with hair sticking up 2 feet from her forehead. She looked like the world's most brutal Japanese porcupine. But she was a fantastic in-ring competitor, and the two had some really good matches. Michelli and Nakano had previously had a heated rivalry in the WWF when Michelli, hoping to boost the status of women's wrestling, which had never been taken seriously in the U.S., urged McMahon to bring in some of Japan's top stars. McMahon, however, thought Michelli would be better served by taking on the 350-pound Rhonda Singh, who he dubbed Bertha Faye, Queen of the Trailer Park. Medusa was more than happy to get out of the WWF when she had the chance. Playing to the xenophobic nature of pro wrestling crowds, especially those containing thousands of likely inebriated bikers, the Hog Wild encounter saw the two fight for the right to smash their opponent's motorcycle. It should be noted that Bull's manager was the diminutive walking Japanese stereotype Sonny Ono, who would later file a lawsuit against WCW for racial discrimination. This, despite his claim that he'd ride his bike, quote, like a kamikaze during this match. Anyway, despite the best efforts of Nakano and Ono, who unfortunately did not attempt a suicide mission with his Honda, Medusa got the Duke and took a sledgehammer to the bike, to the cheers of the crowd. Heading into the main event, the New World Order had yet to reveal any new members. At least, not officially. During the Outsiders matchup against Sting and Luger, it looked as though Luger would get the submission victory over Hall. However, referee Nick Patrick accidentally on purpose clipped Luger's knee, allowing Hall to roll him up for the pin. This would lead to a long angle, during which Patrick would become the official for the group. However, at this point, Patrick was not officially a heel, and the NWO still hadn't bolstered its ranks. Again in the main event, it looked as though Giant had things in hand, until Hulk Hogan walloped him in the back with the title belt, leaving the big guy flat on his back for the next 15 minutes. They must have replaced the gold with lead. Metallurgic inconsistencies aside, the win gave the NWO their first championship, and Hogan took the spotlight atop the card once more. Out came longtime Hogan lackey Ed Leslie, the man of a thousand horrible gimmicks. Fans had last seen him as the Booty Man, a character who shook his ass at the camera, to the delight of no one, and used the high knee, get it, as in high knee, as his finisher. Since the Hog Wild event fell on Hogan's birthday, Leslie, in an effort to suck up to the Hulkster, brought out a cake. Hogan thanked Leslie, then proceeded to have the Outsiders beat the crap out of him. What an ingrate. They then proceeded to spray paint the world title belt with the initials NWO as the announced squad once again cried foul. It was around this time that the New World Order began air vignettes on WCW shows. These were filmed entirely in black and white and featured bizarre camera tricks and sound sampling. They looked as though someone had filmed them with a half dozen shaky handheld cameras, all of which had faulty zoom lenses. At the end of each of these segments was a black and white message that simply read, "The preceding announcement has been paid for by the New World Order." It was completely unlike anything the wrestling world had ever seen, very cutting edge, and so out there that fans immediately paid close attention. Lesson not learned. As we noted previously, ratings don't change overnight. Countless wrestlers' main event pushes were given up on due to the fact that upper management has no patience. Look no further than the Nexus angle in 2010. The group, consisting of Wade Barrett, Skip Sheffield, who would become Ryback, Daniel Bryan, and others, debuted in June and was pushed to main event status, destroying Vince McMahon, Ricky Steamboat, and several other legends before entering into a feud with John Cena. Scant weeks later, the group had not only been defeated by Cena, but were forced to disband. Patience, Stephen Hunter. Even Eric Bischoff had it once upon a time. In fact, fans paid close attention to just about everything the group did at this point. They did interviews in which they'd say things that almost appeared to be a shoot, or real life, which no one else in the industry was doing. They interrupted matches, threatened announcers, and basically had the entire promotion on the run. More than anything, though, they did exactly what they said they'd do. They'd claim they would win belts, and then they did. They'd say they'd beat people up, and then they did. And, most importantly for the company, they were adding viewers. With the NWO invasion as the focal point of the promotion, the ratings for Nitro began to pull away from Raw, generally beating the competition by a full point. They were nearing 4.0 at the time, far and away the best ratings Nitro had ever achieved. Seeing that the New World Order had fans on the edges of their seats, it was decided that the time had come for them to add more members. Following an attack on his stablemates in the Dungeon of Doom, Giant came down to the ring, apparently looking for revenge against Hogan and his crew. However, in a moment that made absolutely no sense from a storyline standpoint, Giant turned on his team and joined up with the NWO. The reason this made no sense was that Davey Boy Smith was supposed to be the fourth guy, but the day he was scheduled to jump ship from the WWF, He instead re-signed a 5-year contract. Even though the members of the NWO were technically the heels, fans cheered like crazy for the giant turn, mostly because the four so-called bad guys were overcoming incredible odds and were on their way to destroying 8 top WCW names. During the Giants' official induction into the group, Scott Hall, acting on a goofball impulse, asked if Andre the Giant was really this Giant's dad, referring to a pathetic angle a year earlier in which WCW had claimed that as a fact. Visibly upset at Hall's sudden ad-lib, Giant shot Hall a deadly glare and replied, "Don't go there." Shortly before Giant's turn, Ted DiBiase had shown up at Nitro, sitting in the crowd. He would eventually act as a mouthpiece of sorts for the New World Order. The storyline made a little bit more sense. Furthermore, since DiBiase's character in the WWF was that of the Million Dollar Man, it was explained that he was the benefactor who enabled the group to bring in high-priced talent and air commercials on WCW television. The group had member number 5. Member number 6 turned out to be a very shocking turn, as WCW's number 1 guy turned against his company. Sting. But it wasn't really Sting, and it was the beginning of a tremendous angle that would set the stage for the most successful pay-per-view in WCW history. Ironically, though, the very first angle they shot in this storyline was such a turnoff for fans that approximately 700,000 people immediately switched channels. The angle began on the September 9, 1996 Nitro. The NWO's familiar black limo was waiting in the parking lot as Lex Luger chased after the group. Out of the car and into the murky night came Sting, who with the help of the rest of the group proceeded to pummel Luger. This made little sense, as Sting had been the most vocal against the invaders and had, in fact, begged Flair and Anderson to join himself and Lex Luger to take them on in the upcoming War Games match at Fall Brawl. Team WCW seemed to be in a shambles. After all, if Sting was now on the other side, who would defend WCW's honor at War Games? Aside from the War Games match, the most notable aspect of Fall Brawl 1996 was the incredible number of outstanding matches on the show. Not only did Chris Jericho make his WCW debut against Chris Benoit in a fantastic bout, but Juventud Guerrera, Chavo Guerrero Jr., Super Calo, Rey Mysterio, and Diamond Dallas Page all had incredible outings as well. It proved to be a formula for which WCW pay-per-views would become known. Fantastic undercard matches, followed by main events featuring big names that weren't so great as far as wrestling action was concerned. And when Sean Waltman, in the WWF as the 1-2-3 Kid, joined the NWO as 6, you know, because he was the real 6th member since Sting hadn't really joined, the group found itself with a talented worker to help carry the load in their main event matches. Waltman was actually set to debut at Hog Wild after the WWF agreed to give him a release from his contract. However, WCW's plans to debut him kept being thrown into disarray when the WWF repeatedly forgot to send him his release papers. Strangely, his journey back to the WWF years later would also be due to his getting stuck in the middle of a political game. While the main events were largely bad in the ring, it would be a mistake to say they were lacking in drama. Never mind that the drama often made absolutely no sense. Indeed, the War Games match had everyone glued to the action, with the question now reversed. Who would team with Flair, Luger, and Arn to take on the NWO? The question was seemingly answered in an interview immediately prior to the War Games main event, in which the real Sting appeared before his former teammates and pleaded innocence. "All I've got to say is, it's not me. It wasn't me, Lex." It was never explained why Sting waited 6 days to have this talk with his pals, as opposed to calling them immediately to explain that it wasn't really him who attacked them. Luger, Anderson, and Flair didn't believe him. And so, like total idiot babyfaces, the group headed down to ringside by themselves to take on Hall, Nash, Hogan, and their partner, who turned out to be Sting. But of course, it wasn't the real Sting. It was the imposter. The crowd picked up on that fact immediately, even though the announce crew didn't. Minutes later, the real Sting hit the ring, and the announce crew figured it out. However, the rest of Team WCW just stood back and watched the real Sting go to work, apparently stunned by his actions. After laying out the entire NWO, he turned to Luger and yelled, "Is that proof enough for you right there?" He then proceeded to flip Luger off and leave the ring. Stunned by the real Sting's departure, Luger fell prey to the bogus Sting, and the New World Order scored yet another win. To cap off the night, Randy Savage, another good guy who was supposed to be getting the next title shot at Hogan, was completely obliterated by the NWO, giving the impression that he had no chance. As for Sting, a storyline in which he felt that he had been betrayed by both WCW and the New World Order was developed. He changed his look entirely, trading in his trademark Sergeant Pepper-style ring jackets for a long black trench coat. Gone, too, was the spiky blonde hair and the outgoing demeanor. In their place was a silent, almost ghostly figure who closely resembled the lead character in the movie The Crow. He would hang out in the rafters and silently observe the proceedings. Each week, the commentators would question his loyalties, using such clues as the color of his makeup to indicate whether he was NWO or not. He didn't do interviews, and he didn't wrestle, yet he remained arguably the company's hottest commodity. It should be noted that the fake Sting didn't just appear on WCW television. He appeared in video games as well. In what many argue is the best wrestling video game ever made, the Nintendo 64 classic WCW vs. NWO World Tour, the WCW roster had Sting, while the NWO team had, quote, Sting. Yes, Sting, complete with quotation marks, so players would know the difference. Not only did ratings soar, but events also took an almost entirely different direction. Throughout the fall, WWF and WCW became engrossed in the biggest bidding war in wrestling history over the services of Bret Hart. WCW wanted him to come in as the savior of the company for huge matches with Hogan and his cronies. The WWF did not want to lose him. Both sides made huge offers, virtually unheard of in the industry. WCW put a 3-year, $2.8 million contract on the table, while the WWF offered him a 20-year deal worth an estimated $12 million total. Ultimately, he signed what he figured was going to be the last WWF contract of his active wrestling career. This was not the only major signing. Hogan re-signed a lucrative 3-year deal with WCW after claiming that WWF was willing to offer him $5 million per year to jump ship. Nobody really believed it except those who were in a position to call his bluff. Roddy Piper also signed a deal to come in and recreate his mid-80s feud with Hogan. While he could barely move after having undergone hip surgery, it was a smart move by WCW since the Nitro audience skewed much older than Raw and drew an audience that remembered all these big stars from when they were younger. During the early days of Piper's WCW tenure, he was able to move the needle in both ratings and buy rates. The one thing he never understood, though, was the concept of a battle between the two companies. Joe's Bar and Grill was run better than that company, and they've only been open a week. WCW, the war. I never figured it was a war. I wasn't mad at nobody. I just came to fight the guy in the ring. But these guys, the egos got into it. I was like, stop! Sadly, Joe's Bar and Grill could not be reached for comment. And that audience was growing. On August 26, Raw was preempted for the U.S. Open tennis tournament, and Nitro, built around the Sting angle, did an unopposed 4.3 rating, by far its biggest number in history. Things were starting to happen. It had been 5 months since the beginning of the New World Order angle, and they were on an absolute tear. WCW was made to look totally inept, as Hall and Nash won the tag belts and Giant won the United States title, all in short order. At Halloween Havoc, a show with a record-setting $94,000 in first-day ticket sales, WCW put Savage up against Hogan in an effort to regain the WCW world title. But unlike their encounters in WWF, which were phenomenal, this time the match pretty much sucked, likely due to the fact that both guys were starting to get up there in years, and it showed. And speaking of Father Time, he appeared in human form as Rowdy Roddy Piper to end the show. "So you're bored, are you?" Piper began. "I have come here to break your monotony. I am not here to represent the WCW, the NWA, the SPCA, the SOB, although I can be one SOB when I want to be. I'm just as big an icon in this sport as you are, Hogan. Do you know what bothers you? I am the only guy you've never been able to beat." Although that wasn't entirely true, the stage was set for Starrcade 1996, Hogan versus Piper. But before that could take place, Eric Bischoff came out on Nitro and stated that, for reasons he could not get into, the Hogan vs. Piper showdown would not, in fact, take place. Quizzed by the announcers as to the reason, Bischoff stormed off the set. Bischoff claimed that despite his best efforts, Piper was not returning his phone calls or emails asking him to sign the contract to face Hogan. Something wasn't adding up. Soon enough, Piper cornered Bischoff in the ring. The NWO then jumped Piper and revealed its newest member, none other than Eric Bischoff himself. There were several reasons why Bischoff became the on-screen leader of the NWO. The first and most important was that Raw had moved an hour earlier to an 8 to 9 p.m. time slot. Knowing they now had to promote a killer hour of Nitro to keep fans from tuning into Raw, Eric's idea was to split the show in half. Hour one would be an NWO show, and hour two would be the WCW show. People were reacting more to the NWO at all the shows, so Bischoff figured NWO versus Raw would be better than WCW versus Raw. He also wanted to make sure that he was on the air doing commentary at the same time Vince McMahon was, because he took great delight in driving Vince crazy week after week from thousands of miles away. And, of course, being a TV star with the hottest heel group in wrestling sure sounded like fun. Bischoff the character was given leadership in the storylines of the New World Order. From that perspective, it made sense, as who else could orchestrate all these ex-WWF guys coming in or give the invaders so much leeway to get away with things that they reasonably had no right to do. And make no mistake about it, Bischoff was excellent in his role. His smug, arrogant attitude had already alienated some wrestling fans, and he now had the opportunity to be as all-out annoying as he wanted to be. His first order of business was to give WCW wrestlers a chance to join the most prestigious and elite organization the wrestling industry had ever seen, via a membership drive for the New World Order. Effectively, he was telling the entire roster that they were either with them or against them. This led several WCW mid-carders, Big Bubba, Scott Norton, Michael Wall Street, and others, to jump ship and join the heel conglomerate. It could, and will, be argued that this was the first huge mistake Bischoff made with regard to the booking of the New World Order storyline. Before, the NWO consisted of top-tier guys in the industry. Now, it was being watered down considerably as wrestlers who had been nowhere near the top of the card gained easy entry into the previously elite group. The next pay-per-view, World War III, featured an overbooked and confusing 60-man, three-ring battle royal. On the show, Hogan and Piper had yet another confrontation, in which Hogan informed the world that Piper was really just an old man with a plastic hip, going so far as to lift Piper's kilt and show the entire world the scar from his hip replacement surgery. After dubbing Piper Peg Leg Pete, Hogan signed the contract for the Starrcade match, a contract that, according to storylines, Piper himself had come up with. Keep that in mind. It's important later on. Then the NWO beat the crap out of Piper once more, although this time, Piper was able to regain his feet and hobble to the back on his own. The rest of the show was rather uneventful, with a Giant winning the Battle Royal for a shot at Hogan at some undefined point in the future. The contract signing set up Starrcade, which had traditionally been WCW's biggest show of the year. And, much like the pay-per-views that immediately preceded it, it had really good mid-card action from the usual suspects, like Dean Malenko, Chris Benoit, and Eddie Guerrero. In one of the first wins for WCW since the formation of the New World Order, Lex Luger pinned the Giant after Sting snuck down to ringside and whispered something in Luger's ear. He also left behind his now trademark baseball bat, which Luger used to waffle the big guy and score the pin. The main event, of course, was the lure of the show. Despite the fact that both guys were way past their physical primes, Hogan versus Piper had tremendous appeal, especially to more casual fans of WCW. Those fans likely remembered their wars from years past, namely the first WrestleMania and the various MTV bouts they had leading up to it. So the nostalgia factor was kicking in big time. And to be fair, the booking leading up to the match was very strong as well, with both men playing their roles to perfection. Hogan was really beginning to peak as an insufferable heel bully, while Piper did a super job as the never-say-die babyface. While the build-up was good, the match itself was not. It was becoming apparent to even his most ardent supporters that Piper's best days in the ring were long past, and Hogan, despite the novelty of his being a bad guy, didn't look much better. The two men hobbled around the ring as best they could, trading slaps. Piper finally cut loose with a comical punch-kick offense, and Hogan countered with scratches. Suffice to say, this was a far cry from what fans had witnessed earlier in the evening from the superb mid-card action. The crowd fell silent following the inevitable NWO run-in, but Piper was able to get rid of the Giant and locked Hogan in a sleeper, the oldest of old-school moves. Hogan's arm dropped three times, and referee Randy Anderson called for the bell. The crowd was stunned. How long had it been since someone had won a match with a sleeper hold, for God's sake? It didn't take long, however, before they realized that Hogan had been beaten, and they leaped to their feet. As the crowd celebrated, everyone waited for the gold to be strapped around Piper's waist. It never happened, though, because the match was inexplicably a non-title affair. Since Piper himself came up with the contract, we told you that would be important. We hereby nominate Rowdy Roddy Piper as the dumbest babyface of 1996. But we must also decry WCW for promoting a match that was clearly designed to look like a title affair. WCW had given its fans a bait and switch on their biggest show of the year, one that some would remember right to the bitter end. Booking aside, the show would have to be considered a complete and total success. It drew a 0.95 buy rate, higher than any other show the entire year, and it nearly doubled the buy rate of World War III just 1 month earlier. The company also celebrated yet another victory in the Monday Night Wars, demolishing Raw by a margin of 3.51 to 1.64, an amazing accomplishment, considering that on the first Monday night of the year, they had lost the battle 2.61 to 2.52. There was absolutely no denying that the company was on an incredible roll, delivering buy rates and ratings WCW had never seen before. Bischoff had the formula. He had the stars. And, perhaps most importantly, he had the one matchup that everyone was dying to see. And he was going to make them wait to see it for an entire year, building up not only the anticipation, but also the inevitably enormous buy rate. Yes, he had the whole world in his grasp, and as hard as it was to believe, 1997 was only going to get better. Part 2. The Rise. Hulk has control over what he does. We don't mind, because obviously he's doing it right. It helps